means stop me, ask any questions you might have. So rather than the standard sort of QKD lecture, I thought I'd sort of tell you some of the untold story that never gets disclosed at some of these things, because there's actually some interesting stuff that goes on with Alice and Bob and Eve, but light's never really shed on it. So just briefly what I'm going to talk to you about first. I'll give you a bit of motivation, well, a bit of Bob's motivation, and also some motivation for you guys for why you'd even care about what I'm going to tell you. Go through sort of the protocol and the security for the system that I've built, give you some of the details, and show you some experimental results. So first off, I want you to meet Bob here. Some of you might know him as Martin, but around the IQC, we generally know him as Bob. Overall, nice guy. He has one problem, though. So I don't know how to say this. His fidelity with the ladies, let's just say that it's much less than one. He likes to see girls in sort of a superposition of each other. And generally, when one of them finds out, well, you can imagine, I mean, the whole state of affairs just collapses. And I mean, with a very high probability, the same result occurs. I mean, just sort of over and over again. They're never too happy when this all happens. So, Bob's a good friend of mine. And one day, he met Eve. See, Eve's usually classified as the evil person in these schemes, but in truth, it's really not her at all. So one day, Bob met Eve, who works at the IQC here. And I mean, it was love at first sight. They did everything together. They even helped put together this lovely conference that we're all at. And Bob, I mean, he swore to me he was going to change his ways. They even lived together. He was going to change his ways. He was going to be a one-woman man. That was, of course, until Alice showed up. And I mean, you can see, I mean, it was next to impossible for Bob to sort of stick to this newfound one-woman kind of deal that he was going to try. And I'd been around to see Bob's multiple beatings. So when he came to me saying that he needed some secure way to talk to this newfound interest of his, because before, these girlfriends had always sort of picked up the phone at an inopportune time, seen one of his emails, and found out that there were some other girls in the picture. So he needed a secure way to talk to his newfound love interest, Alice. So, neglecting the moral implications of this whole thing, I decided that I'd build him a quantum key distribution system to let him do this. So, just a little bit further motivation for some of you guys, why you'd even care about this. I mean, cryptography's gone on for centuries, so you can see a Scitali up there, the substitution cipher, Enigma, and then some more recent stuff, the public key cryptosystems that were developed by Diffie and Hellman. And then one of the more sort of famous ones that still gets used a lot today. You probably don't know the people, but you probably know the acronym RSA. All of the stuff that we use on the internet today is predicated on the assumption that certain mathematical problems are computationally complex. They're going to take too long to do in order to ever be broken. But as we all well know, we have Shor's lovely factoring algorithm, and as soon as we build a quantum computer of appreciable size, we're going to be able to break all these cryptosystems out there today. Which, when you actually stop and think about it, is a pretty big deal. All the online banking you do, any kind of secure emails you want, I mean, it's a big deal in today's world. There is one provably secure algorithm down here, the Vernon one-time pad. Basically, if two people share a secure random bit string, as long as the message that they want to encrypt, they can encrypt with one key, send it across for anybody to look at, and decrypt on the other side, and there's no statistical attack anybody can ever do. So, I mean, back in some of the wars, you actually had people with sort of the titanium attaché case attached to their arm, taking these keys between countries and between people. But, I mean, in today's digital world, that's not terribly, terribly feasible. But what we're going to see is that quantum mechanics gives us a means to distribute these keys. So we're going to use a quantum key distribution protocol called BBM92. And this, coupled with the Vernon one-time pad, is going to give us the ability to distribute shared, secret, random bit strings, which Alice and Bob can use to encrypt and decrypt their little love communication there. And it's going to give unconditional security. There's no longer computational complexity assumptions in here at all. So just sort of the general setup, we're using the principles of quantum mechanics and two things in particular. So we're going to use a psi minus entangled Bell state. It's in the anti-symmetric state, so it looks sort of the same no matter which way you look at it. And then the no cloning theorem, and I guess a third thing is that measurements disturb your quantum system are going to guarantee security for us. So let's have a look at the protocol first. So here's Alice and Bob wanting to communicate here. We're going to create a source of entangled photon pairs and distribute them between Alice and Bob, with the possibility of an eavesdropper here, Eve, who's just checking up on her man, listening in to these particles that are distributed. Alice and Bob are going to perform a polarization measurement randomly in one of two complementary bases, and it's the two bases that are going to give us security here. And then they should measure, with nobody listening in, anti-correlated results because of the property of the state that they're using. And if they just made a classical bit value assignment of h and plus are going to go to a bit one, 0 and b and minus is going to go to a bit 1, they should, at the end of the day, end up with a shared random bit string. And it'll be secret because any eavesdropper that's listening in is going to inevitably induce errors into the state and into their measurement results. So that if Alice and Bob estimate a bit error rate, they'll be able to tell whether anybody was listening in and whether their key's secure or not. So that's where the security's going to come from. And just an example of the protocol running, we're distributing these pairs of photons. Alice and Bob make a measurement, choose a basis, make a measurement. Anytime they're in a different basis, the result's meaningless, they can't use it. If they're in the same basis, they can start doing other things. Bob has to invert. If you use it for security, then basically you're publicly disclosing it, so you're not going to use it in your final key. Otherwise, it ends up down here in your final key. And you can see immediately just how this is secure against a simple intercept-resend attack. So if Eve's sitting in there measuring these photons as they come along, well, because Alice and Bob are randomly choosing a basis, her best strategy, if she's just going to individually attack these photons and measure, is to randomly choose a basis. So half the time, if Alice and Bob were going to measure, say, in the HV basis, half the time Eve could guess right. She'd get a measurement result, which was vertical here, and we have to attribute her all the power that quantum mechanics allows, so she has a single photon creation machine, creates a vertically polarized photon, goes along to Bob, and they're none the wiser. The other half of the time, though, she's going to measure in the wrong basis, and basically her measurement result's now going to become random. But as far as she's concerned, she's measured, say, a plus 45 degree photon here. So she creates one, sends it along to Bob, and now he looks at it in the proper HV basis, and his result's random. So basically, with 50% times 50%, with a 25% probability, Eve's going to give Bob the wrong answer because of her tampering. So if they estimate the error rate and find something around 25%, they know Eve's listening in. So just sort of, that was a really simple example. Further security, there's a couple different kinds. The first one's symmetric individual attacks. So just Eve does something to each photon individually as it comes in. And you can prove security there as long as the bit error rate's below 14.6%. And it's basically just you're taking a look at the maximum Shannon information that Eve could have gained based on her optimal measurement strategy and making sure that that's less than the mutual information between Alice and Bob. And then there's coherent attacks, which is sort of the most general thing. So these photons, the stream of photons are coming by Eve, and she could, say, be weakly entangling another quantum system with these photons as they go by. Wait until Alice and Bob publicly disclose all their measurement bases, basically gain as much information as she's going to, and then make the best possible measurement she could to gain as much information as possible. And so the proof for that's much less straightforward, so I'll just sort of quote, it's sort of 11%. As long as you're below 11%, you're still secure against that kind of attack. That's sort of the most general attack. And just quickly, I mean, Eckert's original intuition sort of still holds true, is the fact that the statistics of an entangled Bell pair, pure entangled Bell pair, just can't be replicated by anything other than an entangled Bell pair in a completely independent third quantum system. There's no three particle quantum system that anybody could give Alice and Bob that would tell Eve anything about the keys that they measured. And then lastly, we're using a free space link here. Why? Well, there's lots of QKD things done in fiber. inherently you're limited by distance. It's single photon measurements you're doing here, and as good as fibers are, eventually you just don't see anything out of your fiber. So you're limited to about 100 kilometers. Also, there's a sort of a fiber measurement mismatch for wavelengths. Fiber's really good at 1550. Detection sucks there. And then lastly, birefringence. So we want to use the polarization degree of our photons to generate keys. And it turns out that optical fibers mess with your polarization. They induce a random unitary on your photons as they go across. So it's not very good to use fibers if you want to use polarization as your degree of freedom. And lastly, the thing that gets quoted all the time is this is sort of towards global communication. If you can manage to stick this source now on a satellite, then you can sort of broadcast sort of all across the Earth. You're not worried so much, because it's been proved that you can go the same air mass along the ground as what it would take to go up to a satellite. So you can bounce photons around up there, and they're not going to interact with anything too much. So just the details of the system. This is all the stuff that we have to do. We have to transmit these photons. Alice and Bob have to measure them. They need to time tag them so they can figure out which photons go with each other. Sift it down to a raw key, figure out what the error rate was, whether Eve was listening in. Do some error correction, because nothing's ever perfect. And finally, privacy amplify away all the information that they've revealed during the protocol. And at the end of the day, they should have a secure system. So this has been talked about five times now, so I'll just quickly go through it. We use parametric down conversion to create our photon state. The only thing you really need to look at is, say, this line. So this is what gets produced in the crystal. There's a pump laser field here, and then two vacuum modes. You're going to annihilate one of these laser photons, and you're going to create two orthogonally polarized photons. And then the phase matching conditions that you always hear tossed around are conservation of energy and conservation of momentum that begin to look like deltas as you go to some limit. Everything comes out on these two cones, and the way you get your entangled state, because the top cone's always vertically polarized photons, the bottom cone's always horizontally polarized photons, you cut it at the right angle, you get the cones to overlap, and then if you look at the intersection points, you know you're gonna get a photon on either side to conserve momentum, but before measuring polarization, you have no idea what you're gonna get ahead of time. So the way you describe that is an entangled state. So here's our source. Pump photons go through our nonlinear crystal here, and then they get divided up because they come out at a small angle to each other, with one going to Bob and one going to Alice there. There's a couple things you got to take care of on either side with compensator crystals, and that's basically that inside the crystal you get two effects, transverse and longitudinal walk-off. Basically, the two polarizations travel at different speeds in slightly different directions, so that you could theoretically discern just by measuring their temporal ordering or their spatial separation which photon is which. So you got to compensate for that. The way you do that is you stick in a half-wave plate, flip each photon's polarization, and then stick it through, because there's two arms, you stick each photon in each arm through a crystal half a stick. So effectively they're both going through a crystal that's the same thickness again. And by doing that, you wash out before you could distinguish which was which by their temporal ordering. V always came first. If you flip them around and send them through again, now the temporal ordering doesn't give you any information about their polarization anymore. So you've washed that out. And the transverse walk-off, when they walk off in direction, works something similar, but it's sort of a lesser effect. Here's our free space telescopes. With single mode fiber, we take Alice's part of the photon pair up to the rooftop of the EIT building, expand it into a 3-inch beam, and fire it across to her office in the BFG building. The way they detect, this is sort of your standard detection mechanism these days, completely passive. Photons come in, hit a 50-50 beam splitter. That does your random basis choice, which is actually really nice, because randomly choosing a basis classically turns out to be kind of a hard deal. Randomly, they go one way or the other with about a 50% probability. If they go one way, they hit a polarizing beam splitter that splits it up. H gets transmitted, and B gets reflected, and then they're coupled into multimode fibers. The other way, there's a half-wave plate in there to rotate everything by 45 degrees and effectively do the plus-minus measurement. Now we've got to transform them into electrical signals that a computer can take care of and analyze. So the photons come into a single photon detector, transforms it into a TTL pulse. That comes out, goes into a timestamping unit, which has a very accurate clock fed by a GPS timing unit. For the software, I'm just going to sort of skip over pretty quickly. The way we determine which photons go with which is by coincident detection. Basically, these photons are created in the crystal at the same time. So when two people measure a photon at the same time, taking into account path length differences, that should correspond reasonably well to photons that were created as a pair. If you calculate the accidental rate for our system, it's something like 7 a second, and you're maximizing on hundreds and sometimes thousands of photons a second. So it's a good measure of sort of when you've detected an entangled pair. Calculate the bit error rate, something interesting that I actually just found out. This is pretty useless. Sacrifices 10% of your key. It can give you sort of not the greatest estimate, and so there's no real point in doing it anyways, because your error correction procedure is going to tell you exactly what the error rate is anyways. So something different than the standard QKD picture that's always sort of taught now. It goes through the error correction. We use Cascade, which is an algorithm come up with by Broussard and Savai. Basically, I mean, you can read the words. Basically, it does an iterative binary search to find the errors, corrects them, shuffles the key up randomly, does it again, and it does 4 passes. And basically, looking at sort of their benchmark data and their paper, that with a very, very high probability corrects all our errors. I've only ever seen an error for once or twice. And then you're revealing a certain amount of information as you're doing error correction and disclosing information about your key. So you've got to privacy amplify it. We use a universal hash function that we toss our key into and keep X number of bits. It's not really sort of illustrative to go through that. So rather, just so you have a toy model to think of in your head that was really helpful for me, privacy amplifications, a simple scheme you can use is take your secure key, split it in half, and XOR the two halves together. So whereas Eve might have had, say, 10% of your key, 20% of your key, which might have given her quite a bit of information about what you're sending across in the first case, now to know anything about the final key, she's got to know both bits going into that XOR operation. And so at the cost of shrinking your key a little bit, you've reduced the chances of her knowing a bit in your final key much more. And lastly, I mean, encrypting and decrypting can be as simple as the XOR operation. Just your information in binary, your key in binary, XOR them together and fire them across a public channel. Just to give you a look at sort of the actual setup. So this is our entangled source sitting in the hallway on the EIT building, 6th floor, under some plexiglass. Oh, yeah. In terms of how to do it? Doesn't matter because your key is going to be random. It's randomly generated. And for the first experiments that we've done, it's just a one-link system. So Bob's actually sitting in behind the monitor here, locally detecting his half of the photons. The other half gets sent to the rooftop, like you saw before, into a sender telescope and fired across at the BFG building here in the distance, about 600 meters, to Alice's receiver station. Collimates the beam back down to about 3 millimeters and goes through all the electronics and detection stuff that I showed earlier. So just some experimental results. You align at night first. You sort of see what kind of count rates we're dealing with. So this is with the source blocked. So you've always got some background there. And then this is with the source back in. So we get about a 7% link efficiency when we set it up. But these are really sort of initial things. And then the way you sort of know that you've got an entangled source is you can look at a coincidence matrix and see this high degree of anticorrelation. Classically, you could always get anticorrelation in one basis very nicely, but you just wouldn't see it in the second basis. It's the superposition of two terms that destructive interference to give you the anticorrelation in the second basis. Some experimental results. So this is sort of why I got into the fact that estimating your cube error is it a bad thing to do, because largely a lot of that fluctuation is due to a bad estimate. So this is sort of when it's cleaned up, looking at the whole thing. So why it's kind of pointless to just waste 10% of your key doing it in the first place. And then here's an actual implementation. So these are two independently generated keys, one with Bob sitting at the EIT building, one with Alice sitting at BFG. You just type in your message, encrypts it into this garbage, fires it across the internet, and with the independently generated key, you get the message back. And you can even do it with pictures. You can visualize your key. So it does look like totally random garbage. But when it comes across, aside from one little error that got in there and disrupted a block, it basically comes across just fine. You can see some of the key that was generated and then how the errors got corrected. And the last thing is we tested a Bell inequality. Really what we've got is an entanglement distribution system. So for anybody who's not too familiar with the Bell inequality, you're really just playing with 4 measurement results. combining them in this quantity, that basically, if you look at either term, one of them's got to be zero. So that basically, this whole quantity has got to be plus or minus two. If you convert it into expectation values, then you've got that the expectation value of this quantity has got to be less than or equal to two. And then it's distributive, so you basically end up with the Bell inequality down here. What we actually measure is the CHSH inequality. It's just sort of it's a generalized Bell inequality that is better for experiments. So classically, you can't get better than root 2, or better than 2. Quantum mechanically, with entangled state, you can get all the way up to 2 root 2. So the only thing to take home from this is that we got well above 2 there. Measurements weren't all the way up to 2 root 2 just because you can sort of see our setup here. No good experiment comes without a little bit of duct tape, and it turns out that the detector boxes that we built couldn't put the wave plate in the right place. So we sort of had to modify things on the fly. But as you can see sort of from the Bell parameter there, we were always sort of well above the classical value for the most part. And just some future work that we want to do. We want to automate a lot of this stuff. This is sort of a two-person thing, tweaking knobs in the dark, which is not a lot of fun. So we want to automate it. Lots of other things we can do, some adaptive optics to improve link efficiencies, implement entanglement witnesses. But the biggest thing is we want to get a second link to PI working. So this is looking out of Ray's office. And we want to go up here to the second link. So now, back to Bob's story, because I sort of left it. Turns out that Bob's a bit of an impatient fellow. And he didn't really stick around for my whole security argument. So he wasn't paying attention when he used my beautifully constructed system to the error rate, or the blinking warning light in the background. So when he distributed his key and started talking and whispering sweet nothings into Alice's ear there, unfortunately, Eve there got the whole key, and listened in a little bit. So that, I mean, I'd like to say that things worked out a little bit differently for him this time. But unfortunately, it just wasn't the case, and well, I'll just sort of let you see the aftermath. So I guess with that, I mean, it just goes to show you that it's important to pay attention to security with QKD so that it's actually secure. So thank you very much. You're welcome to ask questions. Yes, go ahead. Nope, just it's a horrible PR project for a QKD link from PI and IQC. We have a quantum connection between the two now. They've done feasibility studies in Europe. I mean, they're trying to get it on the space station, but nothing, what was the year somebody quoted me? Nothing's happening before 2010 or 12, 11? Okay, yeah, not for a little while. I cut him. Essentially, Ray knows the mayor, and so basically, this lovely Y tree that you see here now looks more like an oddly misshapen eye. So it got cleaved right here. Hopefully. So right now we filter temporally and by wavelength as well. So we look at a very narrow sort of 10 nanometers. So the parametric down conversion we look at is degenerate at 815 or so. And we look at just a very narrow band around there. But there's still lots of background rates. So the next thing is we want to filter spatially. So we're going to build a variable size pinhole so that once you've got the system aligned, you put a pinhole in there that really limits your field of view down to sort of a very sort of limited region of the sky. So I don't know yet. We're going to try. Right now we can't. So Lake Hill, back. The water, not really. You go over a little part of the roof here, and that does. You can see the heat shimmer. So it'll be interesting to see what kind of rates we get out of it. We don't know beforehand. Basically, it'll make our beam wander around. Josh? Well, yeah, well, basically different nights. I mean, we haven't gone on a horrible night just because I haven't liked to waste my time. But yeah, like we'll see efficiencies anywhere from like 3 or 4% up to 7%. Hopefully those are going to jump because I think the system was actually sort of defocused a little bit when we were doing these things. Everything runs in real time. So it adds a bit. I don't have a number for you, but it doesn't slow us down in terms of doing this in real time. When the rates get up, I mean, that's because we've got maybe 7,500 coincident events a second. If the rates get up there when we're, say, just doing this in the lab with the two detector boxes directly there, then it starts to slow down a little bit, and you can see a lag. But it adds some, because there's quite a bit of information going back and forth. That's more like just sort of a communication problem, your bandwidth of your internet connections and all that good stuff. Saw another hand. Yeah? Two ways. First, the clocks are roughly synchronized to within about 100 milliseconds of each other, just with a little NIST software app. They're just synced to the NIST time servers. After that, the GPS receiver that's there, besides giving an accurate clock to the time stamping unit, also gives a very accurate one pulse per second signal. So we sync to that. So basically, a lot of other implementations had to have rubidium clocks and stuff at either end, and they had to be highly stable. But they would gradually drift off each other, so that like after 40 minutes or something, they'd lose the lock on their signal because their clocks were no longer accurate. We only have to be accurate for every second, because you just resync it every second to the one PPS pulse. I saw one more hand.